that we know some kind of object. It could be, by the way, galaxies, but for galaxies we do not know size so precisely, yeah? Of size L. We are here and we are interested that if, for instance, this object is at the distance which corresponds to redshift Z from us, yeah? Under which angle on the sky we will see it. So, we put, without losing generality, this thing along a plane where phi is equal constant. So theta only is changing, and therefore angle is given by delta theta. And our problem, and then actually this object is located at some distance which corresponds to redshift Z, our problem would be to determine delta theta as a function of Z and also L. How can we do it? Now, of course, for that, let's assume that this object, of course, is located at the distance high emission. If we are located at high equals zero in this coordinate system, then this high emission corresponds to the moment of time t emission. And then, okay, for instance, object emits light a quantum from here, they come along this geodesic at the moment of time t zero, today moment of time. So now let's express delta theta in terms of L. How we will put it? Of course, it's very easy. We just write what we call metric element in the universe. Ds squared in the universe in general is dt squared minus a squared t, then t high squared, and here we have phi squared high, and d theta squared plus sinus squared theta d phi, yeah? Now look at this metric element, and of course we know that the light is propagating along phi zero, for instance, theta zero radial geodesics, which are constant, and here also is phi zero and theta zero plus delta theta. Yeah? Now, how can we write this distance? What is this? You could write it as an interval between two events, okay, which are happened at this point. These events are the emission of quanta, and this event happened at the moment of time, t emission, yeah, and t emission at the distance high emission. So then, what is this L? Then L is interval, square root of the interval, square root of the interval square between these two events. So L is equal minus delta S squared, delta S squared for these two events, as I said. And what is the interval between these two events? Because they happen at the same moment of time, this thing goes away, right? Because they happen at the same radial distance, this thing goes away also from the interval. And because the whole thing is located in the plane phi is equal constant, system goes away. So what here is left? Only this thing which will become delta theta squared, yeah? And here we have to substitute high emission, correct? So, and here t emission. So this thing could be written as a at t emission, distance, scale factor at the moment of emission, then phi capital, which depends on the special curvature of the universe, sinus, linear function, sinus hyperbolic, high emission, delta theta. Yeah? Everything is very clear, and therefore we could write that delta theta as a function of high emission, and L is equal L divided by A at the moment T emission, phi at the moment high emission. Now, T emission, or high emission, or eta emission, how it could be expressed in terms of high emission? Okay, light is propagated with the speed of light, as you know, and therefore, this eta emission is nothing more than just eta zero in conformal time minus high emission. High emission is this distance, and you know that high is proportional to eta. In some, in a sense, yeah. So therefore, it's equal L divided by scale factor at the moment when light was emitted. Sorry, it's today's moment of time minus distance and phi high emission. Now, if you are interested, how delta theta for the given L depends on redshift, what you have to do? You just have to express this thing in terms of Z, yeah? And formulas I wrote before. Correct? Correct. Now, let's consider in this formula two limiting cases. One limiting case is trivial case, which you know for sure when the object is located very close to us. So what does it mean that the object is located very close to us? It means that the distance high emission is much smaller than eta zero. What is eta zero? It's the size of the particle horizon. So this case corresponds to very small, the case of very small redshift. And of course, in this case, when the scale is smaller than the particle horizon, the scale of particle horizon is subsequently scale of four-dimensional curvatures, then you expect that everything should be like in flat space. And it's really the case, because when high emission is much smaller than eta zero, then this thing, how it could be approximated? A, eta zero minus high emission. This thing could be approximated as just scale factor at the present moment of time, okay, zero, correct? Now, what is this function? This sinus hyperbolic in all three cases, or just linear function. So in all three cases, when high emission is much smaller than eta zero, this function is linear function. So it's 1 divided by, so high emission is of the order of high emission. So a zero multiplied by high emission, what is this? It's physical distance. Therefore, you are getting in this case of delta theta is L, size of the object, divided by d, where d is a zero high emission. So the angular size of the object is inversely proportional to the distance to this object, obvious result. So, okay, triviality. Now let's consider the other case. Let's consider the object which is located very far away from us, close to the particle horizon. What does it mean, this thing? It means that eta zero minus high emission should be much smaller than eta zero. So you see, high emission is very close to the size of particle horizon. So in this case, it's clear that A eta zero minus high emission is much smaller than A eta zero. Because this argument is very small, so it's a scale factor in some very, very early moment of time. Correct? Correct. Now, what happened with phi emission in this case. You see the high emission. When you have these inequalities, the high emission just goes to eta zero. So this function goes to phi high particle horizon, which is constant, of course. You see, because it's given distance. And then you are getting from the for delta theta the following relation. The delta theta is divided, 1 divided by A, which is n minus high emission. So while high emission approach more and more horizon, what happens with this function? It decays, right? It not decays, it becomes smaller because it's scale factor at the early moment of time. So you are more and more approaching horizon, size grows more and more and more. So beginning from some distance, instead of decreasing, but you will be moving your object with a given length far away from you, yeah? The angular size of this object will start to grow, and in fact, when you will move it far away from you, then this galaxy, which is far away, then it should have the angular size which is comparable with the size of the whole sky. And of course, if the luminosity simultaneously would not drop, then these faraway galaxies, they would overshine our sky. They would just cover it like this one. You see? How it could be, you could ask. Yeah? So I will give you two-dimensional analogy which is not complete. Consider ourselves as two-dimensional object which lives on the surface of the sphere. Yeah? And here is the equator. You are here. Light is propagating along meridians, because meridians are on the surface geodesics. Parallels are not geodesics, but meridians are geodesics. Now take some object of the given size and start to move far away from you. So at the beginning, of course, its size is decreasing and goes size. It takes the minimum value on the equator, but then when you cross the equator, yeah, the size will start to grow. And when you will reach the opposite pole, then the light could come along all these meridians and the object will cover your whole sky. You see? So, but this analogy is not precise because you could think that the universe is curved. But here, you see also that this formula is applicable to any universe, k equal plus, minus 1, or 0. So here, what is important, of course, some kind of four-dimensional curvature effect. You see? But this is very unusual effect. And let's actually look how this formula looks like when I will write delta theta as a function of z in a flat universe. Let me consider p is equal to 0 and k is equal to 0 pixels. So in this case, what do I have? In this case, I have relation. Okay, so delta theta as a function of z can be written down as, what did I write here? Here is like this one, yeah? So the emission. So what I will do, I will multiply it by a zero present scale factor and divide it by a zero. It's good? So a zero divided by a emission, what is this? It's 1 plus z. Therefore, the formula takes the following form. It's 1 divided by A, 0, present value of the scale factor, then 1 plus Z. And here I still have L divided by phi high. So L and phi in a flat universe is flat, what was it? Linear function. High emission. High emission is a function of Z, and I found the expression for this thing. What it was? You remember still? So it was 2 divided, I guess, by A0, H0. I said there was here 1 minus 1 divided by 1 plus Z. Yeah? In power 1 half. So now, it was high as a function of Z. In this case. Only in this case. So now I substitute this thing here, and there. I will get that in this universe, delta theta as a function of z is L size of the object, h0 divided by 2, so it's roughly speaking size of the object to the scale of the horizon, and then you have here 1 plus z in power 3 half divided by 1 plus z in power 1 half minus 1. Now, how this function look like? First of all, let's consider set very small. So here you could forget about this thing. Here you will get linear power. So delta theta will be inversely proportional to z. Z is redshift. Z is proportional to the velocities, yeah, at small distances. And velocity is proportional to the distance. Therefore, you are getting, of course, from this formula, normal relation like angular diameter is inversely proportional to the distance. But when z is very large, z here, one, you can forget that you are getting z. Delta theta is increasing proportional to z. So grows with z. So the graph of this function is like this one. So here is delta theta, and here is z. So it's inversely proportional very close to rest. So as it should be in flat space, then it goes down, reach some minimal value at redshift 5, 4, 125, yeah. And then it grows and goes linearly, like this one. But this is true only in flat universe filled by dust. We know from today's observations that universe is flat, but it's filled not only by dust, but also by cosmological forces. Therefore, relation in principle between angular size and redshift is a bit more complicated. Now, how to determine, how we could use actually this kind of relation to determine omega zero parameter of the universe. Omega zero is the current total energy density, okay, to which contribute all possible components. Let me not derive, because derivation is very easy also, the same line, but just more actually integrals. Let me write this formula, delta theta, for the universe, which is filled by P equals zero, by dust, but which is not flat. Or which is for general case, for omega zero, okay? Omega zero is equal to one, correspond to the flat case. But omega zero could be smaller than one, could be larger than one, okay, etc., etc. So in one case it's open, in the other closed. So this relation generalized to this case, but just for the equation of state P is equal to zero, takes the following form. Delta theta is a function of Z, is equal LH0, as it should be, divided by 2, then omega 0 squared, 1 plus Z squared, divided by omega 0 Z, plus omega 0 minus 2, and then here brackets 1 plus omega 0 Z, 1 half minus 1. You see, so it's a little bit more complicated relation when omega zero is different from one. And this relation, as I want to stress, also goes only if universe is filled by dust, but not necessarily with critical density. In the case that there is cosmological constant, this relation is more complicated, it cannot be written down explicitly. The integral cannot be taken through elementary function. But let me demonstrate the idea just for this case. So what should I do if I want to measure, for instance, in this case, when it's filled by dust, omega zero? You see? Now, of course, I have to find some kind of standard ruler, yeah, in this case. And what could I use as standard ruler? I don't want to prove this thing, but just believe me, but the standard ruler, okay, which I could use, could be the first so-called Doppler peak, or the location of the peak. I don't know, you have seen perhaps all this curve for the fluctuation of the temperature of the ground radiation. So there is location of this peak on this picture. And this peak, roughly again, it's not precise statement which I am making, corresponds to some kind of standard ruler, and this standard ruler is nothing more than just the size of horizon at the moment of recombination. So it's 1 divided by Hubble constant at the moment Z recombination. You see, because Hubble constant is usually A dot over A, yeah? So you know that nearly always, besides of exceptional cases, okay, you could take 1, 1, and then it's dot, okay, it's 1 divided by T. Good, good. So now, let me substitute this formula here. Z recombination is the moment where radiation decoupled from the matter, because at this time the temperature was about 3000 degrees and hydrogen became neutral, yeah? And at this moment, okay, this kind of pitch were produced, in fact. So, at this moment, the temperature was 3000 degrees to which redshift it corresponds. How temperature scales if wavelength of background radiation is growing proportional to the scale factor? Temperature is, okay, scaling inversely proportional to the scale factor. Why? Because actual temperature and typical frequency are the same thing. a typical frequency is going down, and one of the scale factor spectra is not changing during this kind of expansion, and it means the temperature in the universe also is dropping with the reciprocal scale factor. So now, where redshift is about 1,000, then of course you could forget here about this thing, you could forget about this term, yeah? Because this term is linear in omega, and this term is square root in omega. So it's 1,000, and this thing is 30 volts. And then this formula for the size, for that recombination, for this standard candle, could be simplified as the following. So it's that recombination is about 1,000. Yeah? Then delta theta, this angle of scale, which corresponds to the size of the horizon at the moment of recombination, will be given by H0 divided by 2H at the moment of recombination, yeah, because 1 over H is L. And here I have omega 0 Z recombination. Correct, yeah? Because, this thing, okay, here I neglect 1, so omega squared Z squared divided by omega 0 Z. So now, what is the ratio of the Hubble constant in the universe? In the early universe. You would find it from Friedman equation. Yeah, k divided by a squared. And here it will be 8pg divided by 3 epsilon, right? And then this epsilon could be written down as proportional omega multiplied by epsilon critical. Correct? Correct. From this equation, you will find that H0 divided by H at Z recombination is nothing more than just omega 0 multiplied by Z recombination Q in power minus 1/2. It's clear why, because H is proportional to energy density is scalar, proportional, square root of energy density, is proportional, and energy density is scalar proportional to A cubed, yeah? So A cubed, and A cubed are the same thing. Z and A, inverse A is the same thing. And omega zero is coming because here you have. So now you take this thing, substitute in this formula, and then what you are getting? You are getting that this angle size of the horizon is 1/2 Z recombination minus 1/2 omega zero in power 1/2. So you see, for the given physical scale, which is the scale of horizon, yeah? The angular size of this region, or the location of the first Doppler peak on the sky, because location corresponds to the angular size in multiples, depends on the omega zero, depends on the total energy of the matter. Therefore, just given this size, I mean angular size of the horizon, 2 divided by H0, yeah, where it is, and then measuring delta theta, we could determine omega zero. Okay, so if I would substitute here for that recombination 1,000, then I would get that this thing is about 0.87 degrees multiplied by omega square root of omega zero. You see, if I would find that this Doppler peak corresponds to the angle of scale, which are smaller than 1 degree approximately, then it would mean that the universe is open. If it would be larger than 1 degree, then the universe would be closed. Of course, the things are a little bit more complicated, but idea is like this one. Measuring the location of first Doppler peak, you could find or you could measure the total energy density of all the components which contributes to the energy density. Just measuring geometry of the universe to which everything, even if we don't see it explicitly, contributes. So, of course, you know that the spectacular result which came first time from Tato experiment boomerang and then maxima was that the location of the first Doppler peak came in the right place. It was multiple about 200, which corresponds about, okay, 0.1 degree. And it was the measurement of the total energy density of the universe, but not direct, by indirect way, okay, via the geometry of the universe.
Yeah, meaning an equation of state, given equation of state.
Yeah, this is actually, this particular formula goes only for p equals 0. When you have also cosmological constant, yeah, then the things are much more complicated, and actually the dependence on omega is not like this part. This thing I took just to demonstrate the thing. Also, standard ruler is not completely standard ruler. The things are more tricky there, but you know that this is the basic idea. And the other, these kind of tricky things are resolved because we know the shape of this peak, etc., etc. If I will have time in this course, I will go to all these kind of finding tiny details because it's extremely messy business, I would say. But you could do it even analytically, not just on computers, as most of the people do. So now, one of the nice things about this thing, it's of course also the measurement which verifies general relativity. Because people sometimes say, quite general relativity is proved by 3 or 4 experiments, and also in some kind of perturbative things, etc., etc., etc. You see, why it verifies general relativity? Okay, let's answer the question. If our space would not be curved, it would be flat, then of course there would be not so unusual dependence for the angular size for the given size. Yeah? So the distance or angular scale would be decreasing always with distance in the flat space. Let's ask question under which angle we would see, for instance, recombination of the scale with the horizon. Or the appropriate scale, well, the scale of the galaxy today, yeah, 1024 centimeter, if the space would be flat. In Euclidean space, the angular diameter of this thing would be just given by T recombination, the time and the moment of recombination, yeah, the size of the horizon, and then divided by distance. And distance to the horizon is T0, roughly speaking. So what is this? You know that scale factor is proportional to T power 2/3, yeah, in flat universe. So therefore, from here, you would get that this thing would be Z recombination in power minus 3/3. And now compare with minus 1/2. So you see, this scale would be in 1,000 times smaller than we really see it, if the space would be flat. So it would be not 0.1 degree, it would be 1 degree divided by 1,000. And of course, this is direct verification of the curvature of the space-time. And all other effects, which are coming from cosmology, is also direct verification of Einstein general relativity in non-perturbative regime. But this one, I think, is demonstrating the things very clear. You see? Okay, good. So now let's go to the other test. This test, or roughly some kind of form of this test, allowed us to measure omega total in the universe, including all dark components. By the way, also, at the beginning, when people were trying to find all this, they were thinking, how they were thinking, okay? To find the total energy density in the universe, you have to find all the components and sum up, etc., etc. But in this case, of course, you could miss easily all dark components. But with the help of gravity, you can find these dark components. Yeah? And when people measure that omega total is equal to 1, then of course, one of the things was where is this bloody missing energy. Because omega total equal 1, you cannot go so easy, you cannot get so easy. Since people know from a lot of things, or knew from a lot of things, in particular from nuclear synthesis, is that the amount of variance in our universe cannot exceed the maximum 5% of the total energy density. Why? Because otherwise no deuterium would survive. Yeah, all deuterium would be burned out and you would never get what people see. People see the order of 10 minus 5. Then people, of course, were measuring this kind of rotational curve for the galaxies. Then they were considering virial dynamics of the clusters, but they were never able to get in so-called dark matter. They were assuming that this is dark matter. Yeah, never able to get more than 30% of the total energy density. And the question, which of course arises this time, was where is this other missing 70% of the energy? And these other 70% of the energy will discover about the same time as Boomerang came, yeah, it was 99, and they were discovered with the help of Fiery Mode supernova, which measures the acceleration of our universe and which discovered some kind of homogeneous, not clustered component, okay, with a negative pressure, which people call dark energy. You see? Because, by the way, also, there was actually quite funny thing since when I was studying to write books in cosmology, I had some colloquial, then we had some kind of misunderstanding. Because, you see, for me, matter was everything. Because for the general relativist, matter is everything what is in the right hand side of Einstein equation. Yeah? And in addition, I learned quite a lot of Marxism-Leninism. And for Marxism-Leninism, any kind of energy is also matter, you know? And we could understand each other with this guy because he was saying dark energy, dark matter. I was saying everything is dark matter, yeah? And he was keeping in mind dark energy. So you know that people introduce actually for this kind of matter, this negative equation of state, the name energy, yeah? Dark energy. And they started to distinguish these two things. But before I was a little ignorant of all this vocabulary, which actually plays more and more and more important role in science, as you know. Because if you go to the university, you write one more paper, so it's a big difference, yeah? Like quintessence or something like this one. So, then, of course, you see, you have to realize what is this. And there is some kind of conflict between vocabulary of general relativism and astral physics. You have to keep this thing in mind, yeah? Always. But I think, okay, now, of course, there is some kind of consensus that people call matter everything would have pressure equals zero. And energy, I think this matter is negative energy. So then, of course, when this dark energy thing appeared, I had bet with Alex Vilenkin that this cosmological constant of dark energy will decay in half a year. I lost bet. But for me, the most convincing arguments were, of course, not even supernova. Because in supernova, nevertheless, there is a lot of scattering in the point. There is a lot of systematics. We do not know the luminosity even within certain subclass of supernova 1A. Because supernova 1A also are subdivided into certain subclasses. How this actually supernova 1A are defined? You know, when they blow up, then their luminosity is changing. And for a broad class of supernova, this luminosity curve, change of the luminous details, are looking the same. But if you pre-select this supernova 1A, yeah, with this tails, then there are two subclasses of them, and also luminosity there varies, I think, from one subclass is 20% from the other. But if you restrict yourself by a certain subclass, then even within this subclass, luminosity varies by 20%. Then there could be dust also on our way. You could not distinguish really this thing, actually, dust absorption or cosmological constant, if there would be dust. Therefore, these results are, of course, exciting, but not 100% certain. And they became 100% certain when people measured second order peak, this peak, yeah, on this curve. Because, okay, later on, in next lecture, I will try to show you that if you will fix the height of this peak, the location of this peak, then without presence of dark energy, you will never be able to explain this second order peak. You just will kill it. You see, so dark energy helps us to keep it at this much more convincing result. You see, so after that I gave it better. But you see, it was amazing thing. When this supernova result came out, then Physics Today, or maybe Scientific America, published very big paper, very big issue, just related with this kind of question. There were four papers, three by experimentalists, very nice, yeah. One by theorists, okay, it's okay. But the most amazing thing was front page of this Scientific American. It was written down, said, people discuss something unusual, and now inflation is in trouble. It's killed because it never predicted this kind of dark energy. And it's clear that the guy, of course, journalists could not write it. Yeah, because journalists perhaps never heard before even about inflation, or maybe something heard, but of course, actually, he took an interview from some guy who also had no idea what is inflation, in spite of the fact that he's a scientist. Because inflation never predicted any kind of particular equation of state. Inflation will say that only the total should be equal 1. You see? And instead of saying that inflation dead, okay, the guy could say that inflation now nearly confirmed. Because you found the missing energy. Because, you see, I will tell you later when I will be speaking about inflation, that when people could not get more than 30% in this dark matter, they start to panic and then invented this kind of junk, which is called open inflation, yeah? Just to be on safe side. But it's okay, yeah, I can tell about this thing a little bit later. But now let me go not to CMB, but let me tell you about this supernova, what they measured and how the result came out. So for that I will need to consider so-called luminosity redshift relation. So this thing assumes that I have some kind of standard candles or object with the given luminosity which I know, and of course when I am putting this object far, far away, the larger redshift, then the apparent luminosity is decreasing. And it's a function of that. So my problem is to determine apparent luminosity, which I determine F, as a function of Z, given the total luminosity of this supernova. Apparent luminosity is okay, energy per centimeter squared per second, yeah, which I am getting from this supernova. So let me consider myself here somewhere. It's some supernova which is exploding, okay, with a given luminosity, L somewhere here at the distance high emission. Very good. Yeah. Now, where this supernova exploded, then it emitted symmetrically quanta in all directions, of course, and then this quanta comes to me in some shell, and if I would consider the interval of time delta eta here, during which this quanta were emitted, then this quanta, or quanta, will be bounded by spherical shell of conformal width delta eta, correct? And then how I would calculate apparent luminosity? I just would take and calculate how much energy all this quanta in this shell actually carries. Per watt square centimeter. So, during time interval delta eta, the total emitted energy by supernova was equal to total luminosity multiplied by physical time interval delta t emission, which corresponds to this delta eta. Yeah? So, or this thing would be written down as total luminosity of supernova multiplied by scale factor taken at the moment of emission multiplied by delta t. Now, when these quanta are going to me, what happens with this? What happens with this energy? Every quanta is redshifted, therefore energy also is dropping down, yeah? Because of the redshift effect, inversely proportional to the scale factor. Therefore, at the moment where this radiation will come to me, the energy located within this shell, or delta E at the point of observation, will be equal delta E at the point of emission, multiplied by the ratio of scale factor at the moment of emission to the current value of the scale factor. Correct? Now I will take, okay, here, substitute, and then I will get the delta E observation will be equal to L multiplied by A square at the moment of the emission divided by the current value of scale factor, and delta eta. So it's the total energy within shell. Now, okay, this shell pass through my position during the time interval delta eta, which corresponds also physical time interval delta t observation, and also all this shell or all this quanta allocated on the spherical shell of the area of this spherical shell, what it will be at the moment of reception. It will be 4p a 0 squared multiplied by height squared okay, as the distance of emission. So it's the area of this shell. It's clear from this formula. So a flat universe will be 4 pi r squared. Clear. So now the physical width of this shell is delta t, shell which is a at the current moment of time multiplied by delta eta. Correct? So if I know shell, I know time interval, how I will get volumetric luminosity, apparent luminosity. I just divide the total energy by the radius of the sphere and by time. Correct? And then I'm getting formula for the apparent luminosity, okay, which is delta E, all energy within the shell divided by size of the shell, when it crosses me, divided by width of the shell, or delta T, T shell, I am getting the following formula. It will be L divided by 4P phi at the moment of emission, then A squared T at the moment of emission divided by A 0.4. So this is the formula for the luminosity of some supernova observable. Apparent luminosity is the total luminosity L, okay, which is located at the distance high emission from it. This thing could be expressed in terms of redshift. This thing also, what is this? It's also 1 divided by redshifts, 1 plus 1 squared. So I can rewrite this in the form, because A 0 divided by A emission is 1 plus Z. Therefore, I could rewrite this formula like this part. So F as a function of Z will be equal L divided by 4P A 0 squared, then phi squared, which is high emission, which is function of Z. Okay, for that we derive formula 1 plus Z squared. So here now you could take this dependence, yeah, for high as a function of Z, for instance, in dust dominated flat universe, substituted here. You could take even in non-flat dust dominated universe the expression, okay, which I use here, which is similar like this one, substitute here, and you will get a lot of things also. So, and also, what, how it's called? Astrophysicists, how astrophysicists present this kind of result, but it's clear from here that there is definite function of the volumetric luminosity as a function of redshift, and of course, because high enters here, yeah, it allows us to measure cosmological parameters, because this kind of thing depends on the cosmological parameter. So, but let me actually simplify this formula in one particular case. Because usually what astrophysicists measure, not measure how they present result, they define so-called volumetric magnitude, which is minus 2.5 logarithm basis 10 from this f. Ask me why it's so. I have no idea. It has historical origin, and actually the origin of this formula, okay, you understand, it's close in the middle ages. So, but doesn't matter, astrophysicists still use, actually, or astronomers still use this kind of notation, and the more weak is apparent luminosity, then larger average corresponds, because there stands minus here. So let me substitute in this formula this thing, and then you will get...
Is it going to change?
Good. It just reversed, because if you have more luminosity, then you will draw it somehow here.
When is the convention going to change?
Convention? I don't know. Ask this guy, why you ask me?
Ask you,
no, I actually, you see, I didn't invent these conventions. I do not carry responsibility for this logarithm basis then, yeah? So, it's 1 plus z, if I substitute this, it's plus 5 log 10, and then here f high emission as the function of z. And plus, of course, logarithm of L. But if L is the same, here I use a standard candle, yeah? Then this is nothing more than just constant. We shift your graph like this one or like this one. You have to be sure that luminosity is the same. You don't need even to know what is this luminosity if you are not interested, if you are interested only in dependence M as a function of Z. And I can take, for instance, case when Z is much smaller than 1. And then I could use here for phi f, of course, linear expansion, because you know that at small distances, this is always linear function of this thing. Then I could simplify these integrals in this limit. And then the formula which I will get for Z smaller than 1, for f bolometric, will be the following. As a function of Z, it will be phi log 10 Z minus 2.5 divided by logarithm, now natural logarithm, yeah, 10, 1 minus Q0 Z, and plus terms which are Z squared, where Q0 is nothing more than just minus a to dot divided by a h squared at the moment t zero, so it's also called deceleration parameter. So it's second derivative of scale factor divided by Hubble constant, and which is written down like 1/2 omega zero 1 plus 3 p over epsilon. So you see, the slope of this, the linear part of the slope of this curve depends, or coefficient depends on omega zero, which we could determine in standard ruler. And it depends also on the equation of state. Therefore, of course, from this formula, you could guess already that if you would be able to measure the slope of the linear part of this curve, you will be able to determine P over epsilon. This formula works, I mean, this kind of approximation, of course, works z much smaller than 1, but what does mean z much smaller than 1 in this particular case? It means, in this particular case of the universe which we have, that you cannot apply this formula to redshift more than 0.3. For sure, it fails there. So if you consider redshift larger than 0.3, please use always this formula with this complicated integral, which you cannot calculate in general. And redshift, or black, or not black holes, this supernova which we measure are located usually at redshift 0.81. So you should not use formula for that. I wrote this kind of linearized approximation only because I wanted to show you that this kind of curve, M as a function of Z, is changing, how it's changing, depending on the equation of state of the matter. You perhaps have seen many times in the talks, not everybody, but for sure certain people, all these curves which people show from supernova observations. So they usually present the things like this one. Here is M polarimetry, and here is redshift set. So here is 0.5, here is 1, 1.5, etc. And you see, I could consider, for instance, closed universe for which omega lambda plus omega meta is equal to 1. Not closed universe, flat universe. And could vary combination of these two things. Yeah? And then it's clear from this formula, the deceleration parameter will be changing, of course, because the deceleration parameter contributes this guy very much, since it gives negative pressure. And of course, the curve will be changing. So, for instance, in omega total equal 1 universe, without cosmological constant, it would go somehow like this one. So you understand, Lati is M parametric, weaker is, or smaller is this apparent luminosity. Now, if I would consider, so it's omega M is equal 1, omega 0 is equal 0. If I would consider the universe where there is no dark matter, nothing, just cosmological constant, which is equal 1, then what should happen with all this for the given total luminosity, what should happen with apparent luminosity? It should be smaller, of course, because you understand that in this accelerated universe, actually, the thing should become, I mean, distance should become bigger, larger. And the curve would be like this one. So I send you that M bolometric, large M bolometric correspond to the weaker image. So it's omega lambda equal 1, omega M is equal 0. Now, if you would consider combination, okay, 30% of dark matter, omega M, is 0.3, and omega lambda is 0.7, you will get the thing somewhere in between. So, what people did, they measured this curve, and they found that most of the supernova are located somewhere here. So, I think actually a lot of supernova were measured for set of the order of 1, 0.8, and even more than 0.8, till 1.5. And of course, from here they concluded that when omega total is equal 1, how we got it from boomerang, that in the universe there should be cosmological constant. But you know that these points are scattered. There is also some kind of systematics there. And plus, there are statistical error bars. Nevertheless, okay, it's for sure, nearly for sure, you could say that it's not this case and it's not this case, of course. You see, the formula which I wrote, this linearized approximation for small set, is valid, of course, somewhere here, smaller than 0.3. But here all these three curves come together. So you cannot distinguish them practically. Also, taking into account the robots, you see, you would find that there you have to have a tremendous statistic if you want to distinguish this curve. Or you have to know luminosity of this supernova with the accuracy. It's not even accuracy, actually. This whole supernova should have precisely the same luminosity. And of course, now people have some kind of project which would allow us to go to this region. You perhaps heard about this project, how it's called SNAP. Yeah. So it's about 1 billion, and so one day has good perspective to be launched in a few years, other day bad perspective, okay, so it's something like oscillating curve right now, until the people will get money. Yeah, okay, good. So, but this kind of stuff, plus this curve, the presence of second Doppler peak, makes the existence of dark energy, namely the matter component, which leads to the present, in present, to acceleration of the universe, unquestionable. You see? No, of course, if you forget about all these kind of long-scale modifications of the gravity and separate system. So let's speak about more prosaic, think about reality, yeah? So, in this case, cosmological constant, of course, is the best, or how it's called, is the simplest possible explanation. But you could think about some kind of Euclidean set of scalar fields there, whatever you want, and cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But if you just try Euclidean set of scalar fields, that would call it quintessence, yeah, it will not improve life very much. Because as you have to understand anyway, why actually this kind of guy is dominating today. And we will see it in a minute why it's so strange, yeah? But not starting to dominate in the past, and for instance, why it's not so small that we will never see it. Unless if you answer one of these questions, of course, you could write a lot of models, which actually mimic your data, but it's some kind of zoology, it's not physics. Okay, good. So now, okay, I think nearly 2 lectures I have spent to prove you two things, okay, that we could measure two important parameters in the total universe, yeah, in today's universe, we could determine the composition of the universe, yeah, when considering this kind of kinematics and this kind of measurement, and now I want, taking the present state of the universe, go in the past, in the most exciting time, where in the universe, everything was extremely hot, everything was happening very fast. You know from experience, when the things are hot, yeah, then the everything happens very fast. But not on the beaches, of course, or not in the south countries. I don't know, it's exceptional in this sense. So, but nevertheless, you know, the temperature is very high, then the processes are very fast. And you know that these last 10 billion years in the universe, of course, you know, the most boring time, perhaps, compared for the evolution of the universe as a whole. The most exciting time, or the most exciting things, are happened during the first several, not even minutes, I think, second, on fraction of second, and fraction of second. There are 3 minutes is for the boring science, which is called nuclear physics. But for the particle physics, it's much less. And for inflation, it's much, much less. Okay, so let me recall you the composition of the universe, and then let's take this composition, and let's try to move on past. And today I will give you brief blah-blah-blah description of the overall picture of the thermal history of our universe. And then I will tell you what I'm going to cover in the next lectures. Not too much, by the way. But the most relevant things, and the most interesting things, okay, let me say like this, for me. See, some people can run program, okay, forever, it can be much more interesting for them than particle physics, right? It's a question of taste. Now, what is... what is the present composition of the universe? What we know existence of the universe? Composition of the universe. So first of all, the most important component which determines everything is primordial radiation. This radiation, as I said, was discovered accidentally in 1965 by Penzias and Wilson. And today we know its temperature with very good accuracy. So it's equal to 2.73. We know two more signs here, two more numbers. But I don't remember. If you want, you can check it. But for me, it doesn't matter. Yeah? Degrees of Kelvin. If you would calculate the energy density of this radiation according to formula, which I hope you didn't forget, that energy density is proportional to the fourth power of radiation temperature, yeah, then you would find that energy density of this radiation today is 10 minus 34 gram over centimeter cube. It's very, very, very little. And the critical energy density, the total energy density in our universe today, we expect something like 10 minus 29. 10 minus 30, perhaps I don't remember, gram over centimeter critical energy density. So you see today, the energy density of this radiation is completely negligible. It's 10,000 smaller than critical energy density, which is 10 minus. Then we know that there is baryonic matter. There is no doubt that there is baryonic matter, and the proof is, for instance, all of us, right? And this kind of matter enters galaxies, planets, there is actually hot gas in our universe. There could be small stars, small Jupiters, God knows what. But from cosmological, again, observation of the theorem, I told you that this baryonic matter, okay, constitutes perhaps only 4% of the total energy density in the universe. You see? So it's 4% from 10 minus 29. Now, we know that there is dark component. Dark component. And this dark component consists of at least two subcomponents. Namely, okay, there is cold dark matter, CDM, which has equation of state P approximately equal to zero, So, and can cluster, can form actually, can have all these kinds of clusters of galaxies, etc. And this whole dark matter component, as we know from this film mostly, constitute 22%. And there is so-called dark energy, DF. Dark energy, which is some matter with equation of state W epsilon, where W is smaller than minus 1/3, because in this case, okay, we would have already in this case, we would have acceleration. And this cold dark energy, not hot, it doesn't matter, I don't know even, it's cold or hot, how to call dark energy. Yeah, so depends how you would like to interpret the temperatures and the theta. Yeah. So it has actually it contributes 74% in the total energy. So 426, okay, I guess I got half. Yeah. Now there should be also primordial neutrino, perhaps. If this neutrino would be primordial neutrinos. If this neutrino would be massless, then we could even predict the temperature, that the temperature should be in like 1.9 degrees of Kelvin. But as we know right now, the neutrinos are not massless, and who, God knows what is the temperature. And the other more important thing, who cares, because we will never be able to see that, because there is no this kind of devices which would allow us to see this sea of neutrinos. But anyway, they contribute negligible component or negligible part in the energy density. So the basic thing which determines dynamical evolution of the universe are these things. Now, for dynamics of the universe, what is important? Is important equation of state. Therefore, we could take these two things together, because baryons today have equation of state pressure is equal to zero, yeah? And CDM has pressure is equal to zero. And call it meta component, if you want. And now, of course, this thing, how this thing is scaling? How the energy density of this component is scaling? It's scaling, okay, proportionally, energy density in this case is scaling proportionally 1 divided by scale factor 4. You remember I told you 1 over a comes because of redshift and 1 over a cube because the number of photons is conserved. Yeah? Just, okay, volume is increasing. So here is energy density proper 1 plus z fourth. Here energy density is proportional for the matter 1 over a cube. Yeah? Inversely proportional to the volume. So here it's 1 plus z cube. Now, for this component, the energy density, as we derived, is proportional scale factor in power minus 3, 1 plus W. It was in the last lecture, but you could see it immediately from the conservation equation. So here it's 1 plus Z in power 3, 1 plus W. For cosmological constant, W is equal to minus 1, and therefore it's constant. Now let's draw. Let's go in the path. So it needs to very large Z, and let's draw how these energy densities are changing. So here is the energy density, and here is redshift, yeah? So no, let me point it in this direction, because redshift grows here. So Z corresponds, Z equals zero, corresponds to the present moment of time. And then at present, we know what is dominating. Dominating is cold, dark, not cold, dark energy, or quintessence. How it changes when we're going past? For the case of cosmological constant, it stays precisely constant. For a case when there is some little deviation from cosmological constant, it grows a little bit, just a little bit. So we could Write it like this one, constant. Now, second dominating component is, for the dynamics, is variance plus whole dot net, which is scaling like 1 plus Z cubed, yeah? Today it constitutes, okay, something like third part of or half of these kind of things. But it's scaling like 1 plus Z cubed. Okay, so how to draw it? Let me draw it here, yeah? Let me draw it here, and then I do it like this one. So it's epsilon meta, which is proportional plus Z cube. Now, and of course, there is negligible amount of radiation, but radiation is scaling like 1 plus Z fourth. Therefore, okay, I will find that at some moment of time, in past, here the energy density of radiation, because it drops faster, but also if you go in past, it increases faster, was equal to the energy density of the cold matter, of the matter, right? And even before, this radiation was dominating. Now, there is this moment of time when energy density of dark energy and dark matter are equal. So this moment of time corresponds to the redshift, okay, quintessence I use, redshift when quintessence is, amount of quintessence is equal to the amount of matter, it's omega q divided by omega n, the current value of the cosmological parameters in the power minus 1 divided by 3 w minus 1. And this quantity is ranging between 0.33 and 1. For W, larger than minus 1/3, but smaller minus 1. So you understand that where this kind of dark energy component is dominating, if it's dominating today, then it started to dominate only recently, precisely at the moment when we see all these supernovae. You understand? And, of course, the question is why it starts to dominate today, but not tomorrow and not in past. Of course, in past, you could say that it could not start to dominate during the past, because otherwise there would be no stupid monkey or who would ask this stupid question, who would ask this smart question, yeah? This last thing, okay, which I said, is known as anthropic principle, yeah? And this anthropic principle, the people are, what's called digging in landscape usually. But you know, it's not serious science, and therefore I will not speak about it. Let me go to the more realistic things, and let me, okay, just assume that this thing exists. I don't know how to explain it. And let's go in the past. You understand that when you went to redshift 10, then you can forget for dynamics about this component. And when you come to this moment of time, which is called Z equality, then radiation density at this moment of time and matter density are the same. Now, when this moment of time happens, of course you could equate these two things, okay? Then here it will be proportional omega m, and here it will be proportional also epsilon critical. Here you don't need to write it in anything. Yeah, and then you would get that this equality moment of time, but from equating these two things, is given by epsilon zero critical. Critical, you still remember that it was 3h0 squared divided by fpg, omega m, divided by epsilon gamma zero is the present energy density of this radiation, which we can determine because we know its temperature, minus 1, or it's equal to 2.26, multiplied by 10^4, omega m h75 squared, where h75, usually I determined h75, and most of the book people normalize this Hubble constant on 100 by tradition, but it's not very smart thing, because then all these numbers in front, they okay, are very different by factor 4 from the most realistic things which we expect. Therefore, I normalized on 75 because the present data for the Hubble constant, I think 72 plus minus 7%. You see, kilometers over second over megaparsec. And you understand here that if omega m is about 0.3, as it should be, then you are getting that redshift, which corresponds to this moment of time of equality when energy density of radiation and matter are equal, is about 10,000. And redshift, which corresponds to recombination, is about 1,000. You see here maybe 3,000 if you would take more realistic values. So you understand that these two events were very close to each other. One event, recombination, which was here, was important for transparency of the universe. This event was important for dynamics of the universe. And of course, you know that in past, in this case, when radiation starts to dominate, it determines everything. It determines temperature, etc., etc., etc. And I want now to go here in this history and see how temperature was changing and what were the most important events in the past history of our universe. So now, next topic and last topic, okay, brief for today. If the brief thermal history, not of time, but of the universe. But let me before derive you relation, very useful relation, which is valid in radiation-dominated universe between the moment of time and temperature. You see, temperature, of course, temperature of radiation as a function of Z is equal temperature today, 1 plus Z. And energy density of radiation is proportional to T force. Now, how to get relation between temperature in the universe where it's dominated by radiation and time. Only in the universe where radiation is dominated. Use Friedman equation, assuming that omega total is equal 1, so k is equal 0. So then you have h squared, which is okay, a dot over a squared, yeah? And what is this thing? This thing is usually 1 over t squared, and in the case of radiation-dominated universe, it will be 1 over 4t squared, because Hubble constant there is 1 divided by 2t. And also, Hubble constant is proportional to energy. Therefore, every time when you have power law for t, for the scale factor, energy density is scaling inversely proportional to t squared. Just coefficient are different there. You see, because it's always like this one. So then, Hubble constant on one side is like this one. On the other side, it should be given by 8pg divided by 3 energy density of radiation. And the energy density of radiation is proportional to T force. Yeah? From here, you are getting formulas that T is proportional to 1 divided by square root of time. Correct? Now, if you substitute all the coefficients, then you will get nice relation. The temperature measured in mega electron volt is equal to some number of the order of 1, which depends on the epoch in the universe, which characterizes also, which is related to the number of relativistic species at this point, divided by time in seconds. You see? So, remember this formula. It's very easy formula, but it's very useful when you want actually to connect a couple of things, like temperature and time after Big Bang. So, 1 second after Big Bang, temperature was 1 MeV. What is temperature 1 MeV? It's a typical temperature for electrolytic interactions, correct? So, you know that 1 MeV was approximately the time when weak interactions were important. Or the other moment of time, like, for instance, 0.05 MeV, like this one, yeah? You know that there were nuclear reactions there when we formed helium 4, and this is the time about 3 minutes after the Big Bang. This is the reason, by the way, I like it called book. 3 minutes after Big Bang, or 3 minutes, because actually he finished with nuclear reactions. You see it? Now, let's now use this thing and let's go in the past things of the universe. So, and let's write some, how it's called, this family tree, or how it's called, for the universe. What was before, but it's not actually, it's not like family tree, yeah. So, the sequence of events. But let's start from today and let's go in past. And let's say what was the most interesting event with the different epochs. So what does it mean today? Today means 10^16 second, 10^17 second. So it's 10 billion, last 10 billion years. As I told you, the most boring, slow evolution. So what was interesting here, the galaxies were formed, non-linear structures were formed. The stars were formed. But you know that actually everything here happened on the scale of billion years. So these last billion years, okay, everything is slow, but first seconds, okay, things are fast. Now let's go in past and let's ask, okay, what were the other interesting events, okay, physical events in the past in the evolution of our universe? About one event I told you already, it corresponds to redshift set equal 1000. Yeah? So it's 10^12, 10^13 second after the Big Bang. So small fraction, very small fraction, 100 million years, yeah? No, not 100 million even. So that, 100,000 years, yeah? Compared to this thing, after Big Bang. The temperature in the universe, that is 1000, the temperature in the universe was about 3000 degrees. As the temperature is above, these thing, photons were energetic enough to ionize all hydrogen, all helium in the universe, and the universe was untransparent because photons were scattered on the free electrons. At this moment of time, yeah, a little bit before, helium recombined because of high ionization potential, but at this moment of time, hydrogen also recombined. So all free electrons were captured by the nuclear set. And the universe became transparent. Could I ask you why the universe became transparent after free electrons were captured? What is the cross section of the scattering on the free electron? It's Thomson cross section, yeah? And Thomson cross section is 10^-24 centimeters squared. When electron is captured in the nuclei, okay, what kind of scattering we have there? We have so-called relay scattering, yeah, on the bounded electron. It's not so easy actually to start to move this scattering, it's already bounded. Therefore, cross-section immediately fall down by 4 orders of magnitude. But this process is of recombination is extremely interesting. Why? Because recombination, which happens here, is not so-called thermal equilibrium process. It's very complicated things, far away from thermal equilibrium. And here, protons and electrons recombine to form hydrogen atom, but as a result of this recombination, are formed a lot of Lyman alpha quanta. You see, Lyman alpha quanta are the quanta which are emitted when hydrogen goes from 2p to 1s level. They are very sharp and they have incredibly high resonance cross section here. It would be about 10^-16 centimeters. So it's tremendous. 8 orders of magnitude more than the scattering cross section on the electron. And of course, if this Lyman alpha quanta would survive, today we could observe this Lyman alpha quanta as a line. Yeah, which is redshifted but sharp line. But at this time happens some kind of process which never played any role in the nature. Namely, two quanta depletion of Lyman alpha quanta. Because you see, there is 2p and 2s hydrogen atom. Yeah? And there is 1s here. From here, you can go here very easily. Yeah, with emission of line of a quantum. But from here to here, you cannot go with emission of one quantum. Why? Because it's the same parity state. But from here to here, you could go with emission of two quantum. So what happens with this line of alpha quanta? They are captured here, there, as a result of collision. Okay, this state could go to this state. And finally, all line of alpha quanta are depleted as a result of this two quanta decay. The probability for this transition is 100 million times smaller than probability for this transition. But nevertheless, it plays quite important role, and this process of depletion of Lyman alpha quanta determines the rate of recombination. It's the most important and not trivial thing about recombination. Moreover, because the process of recombination, as a result, here, is not instantaneous, but it's delayed, so-called E component of polarization background radiation is generated. And the spectrum of this component depends on the tricky detail of this recombination. And right now, what is measured is in perfect agreement with the standard picture of recombination. The other extremely exciting thing, because you see in the universe some process where this kind of two quanta Lyman alpha depletion plays extremely important role. So, it's of course, you could say it's boring atomic physics, but nevertheless, you see, it's first of all not so boring. It's a little bit complicated, of course. Complicated not in the sense of fantasy, but questions are really messy there. But also, you could do it analytically. I could do it. I don't know about you, but I did it. Now, we go in past, and we say the moment of time. Next interesting moment of time, it's 10, where it was, 10, 11 picoseconds. Just it precedes a little bit to recombination. And I thought that at this moment of time, there was equality of the energy density of radiation and the energy density of matter, cold matter, baryons plus cold dark matter. You see, it corresponds to the red shift of the order of 10,000, for instance. Or even 3,000, 5,000. It's very small interval, so universe just was 10 times smaller. Now, this moment is important from the point of view of particular dynamics of the universe. Because before this moment of time, radiation was dominating and universe was expanding. Scale factor is proportional to square root of t. After this moment of time, scale factor is proportional to t in power to 2. You see? So, and of course, the dynamics of the universe in this moment of time also influence this pattern of the CB background fluctuations. And you understand that, of course, this kind of interval is extremely important for so-called forming this complicated curve which I showed, because this curve is not what generated by inflation. You see, it's the curve which was transformed as a result of evolution in this important time. These three peaks, yeah? Of this baryon radiation plasma and plus cold dark matter. But of course, it was transformed beginning from some original spectrum of quantum fluctuations which was produced before. So these, of course, times are extremely important and observationally verifiable. Now let's go still further in the past. Okay, I have 5 minutes, but I have to cover during 5 minutes, not 10 billion years, but just a few seconds, yeah? But unfortunately, here, proportion is inverse. So, next moment of time, and here, by the way, here already I could start to speak about energies, or about temperatures in the universe. So here I am speaking about time, but I didn't mention electron volt or something like this one, because before radiation, before that, okay, this formula which I wrote there for relation between T and T capital, temperature, time, was not valid. Here it's valid, here the energy corresponds to about electron volt. Now let's go in past, and, okay, we will face with the moment of time 200-300 seconds. So first 3-5 minutes. temperature at this time is about 0.05. Then what happens at this time? At this time happen nuclear reaction. So helium 4, deuterium, helium 3 are produced at this moment of time from deuterium, which was formed before. Why is this time? What is so special about 0.05 MeV for nuclear reactions? Nothing special, but at this moment of time, the abundance of deuterium, which was depleted before mostly by radiation, raised to the order of the magnitude of the order of 1. And through deuterium, these other elements are formed. Because you understand that you cannot form helium 4 in 4 particle collision. The probability is extremely small, the densities are not so high. Therefore, all these elements are formed from deuterium. Okay, but deuterium interacts with neutrons, protons, or deuterium with deuterium. But first you have to form deuterium. And before this moment of time, deuterium could not be formed in big abundances. Why? Because the balance, the binding energy of deuterium is 2.3 MeV. At one glance, it looks actually that it's very high, right? So you ask why actually deuterium was not formed at 2.23 MeV. On the other side, when you know how many quanta you have, p1 atom of deuterium, p1 hydrogen or p1 proton, you have 10 billion quanta, So you would find that the number of these quanta, temperature is slow, but number of the quanta are so small, and they are distributed according to the Planck distribution, you will find all this among these 10^9 quanta, p1 deuterium nuclei, 10^11 quanta, one bad guy who has enough energy to destroy this deuterium. But when temperature drops to this temperature, deuterium abundance becomes very large, and nuclear reactions start. If there would be no this kind of how it's called role of deuterium, then this helium-4, everything would be in equilibrium, would be formed much, much before, because the binding energy of this guy 28 MeV. But because of deuterium, it's delayed. And people call it deuterium bottleneck. The word which was invented by Steve Weinberg after the call when Turner tried to convince him that deuterium bottleneck doesn't exist, but of course they were wrong. Deuterium bottleneck exists really. So, and then at this time deuterium bottleneck falls. Now let's go further. What further we have interest in? One second, and temperature is of the order of 0.5 MeV. What is remarkable about this temperature? Who knows? Well, some people know, but I know that they know this. So, is the rest mass of the electron. Therefore, you expect that when you will go before, then this quanta will be energetic enough to form a lot of electron-positron pairs. After this moment of time, the number of electrons were 10^-8 to 1 photon. Only excess of electrons over positrons survived. But before this moment of time, everything was in equilibrium, and the number of electrons, positrons, and photons were approximately the same. But at this moment of time, when the temperature dropped before the rest mass of the electron, electron-positron pairs recombined, they formed quanta, they heated this radiation which was present already there, and after that, they survived only small excess of electrons over positrons. All positrons disappeared and only small excess survived. Just to get electrically neutral universe, okay, where there are also a little bit protons. Now, so here there was electron-positron recombination. Recombination, and as a result of this electron-positron recombination, thermal radiation was heated, because all energy which was before there went to thermal radiation. I will tell you why it's important 1 minute before or after. So 1 second, again, but temperature, 0.2 seconds, let me take. And temperature is, or T is 1, 2 MeV. So why this kind of energy is remarkable? You know what is the difference between the mass of neutron and proton? How heavy is neutrons and proton? Who knows? By 2.5 electron masses, so it's 1.3 MeV. Okay, neutron, mass of the neutron is minus mass of the proton is 1.3 MeV. Yeah, and this difference, of course, is due to also weak interactions. Also, at this moment of time, actually, if you look the things, okay, at these energies, you will find that processes with neutrino are important. So, at this moment of time, it's weak interaction, or lepton, you can say lepton error, weak interaction error. Two important processes are happening. Primordial neutrino decoupled. And second thing, you see this kind of process, neutron plus electron, is proton plus antineutrino, and vice versa, or neutron plus neutrino, etc. For this kind of processes, the process of converting neutron to the proton. These processes are happening with the strength of the weak interaction. Yeah, also take place at these temperatures. As a result of the decoupling of primordial neutrino, after that, neutrino do not interact with anything. Yeah, and at the moment of decoupling, they have the same temperature as photons. Clear. But then happened the electron-positron recombination, which heated photons, but didn't touch neutrino. Therefore, what would you expect? You would expect the primordial neutrino should have smaller temperature than radiation, because radiation was heated by electron-positron pairs. This is the reason why expected temperature for the massless neutrino would be not 2.73 degrees, but 1.9 degrees. So, okay, 1-2 minutes. Could you survive 1-2 minutes? Because I need really, okay, I want to finish this thing. So, also here, I will skip all blah, blah, blah. And here I could go faster. So let's go, and also there is second process, this process. And this process is responsible for keeping neutrons and positrons in chemical equilibrium. So at this moment of time, this chemical equilibrium is not valid anymore, and the concentration of neutrons is becoming frozen. And after that, there is only free decay of the neutrons. Why it's important? Because the abundance of helium and other elements depends how many neutrons you have. If there would be only protons, you would never form helium, you see? And here, there survive about 33% of neutrons at freeze-out point. Then, because there is this big delay, yeah, because of the deuterium bottleneck, part of the decay, because the lifetime of the neutron, you know how much is it? I guess it's 886 seconds. Something like this one. I can make some small arrow. And during this time, with this kind of time decay, before the moment of recombination, part of the neutrons decay, and from 33%, the concentration of the neutrons falls down to 25%. And this is the reason, and most of them, of course, except small amount, form helium-4. This is the reason why we have today 25% of helium-4. Okay, good. Let's go in past. And then there is the remarkable thing, moment of time, T is 200 MeV. What is this? It's, of course, what is this? Confinement scale. So here, at these temperatures, you expect quark-gluon plasma. So before this moment of time, there was quark-gluon plasma. So all quarks didn't belong to anybody. At this moment of time, quarks and gluons form colorful, colorless states. So, They form here neutrons, protons, and then also pions. Pions, by the way, most of the things go into pions with energy 130 MeV. And, but before this moment of time, you could think about quark pure plasma and about quarks and about free particles. Then you go in past, and then you arrive to very nice time from 10 minus 10 second to 10 minus 14 second. So it's energies between 100 GeV and 10 GeV. 10 GeV, right? Good. What kind of energies are these energies? It's the energies of electroweak theory. And you know that there is the restoration of symmetry or disappearance of this kind of homogeneous component of scalar field, which gives masses to W, Z bosons, etc., etc., etc. Yeah, because the high temperatures symmetry is restored. Why? Because you know that if you take superconductor and you do heat it, then okay, nothing will be left from superconductivity. It's the same thing actually, because the presence of this homogeneous component is the same thing as the presence of superconducting, how it's called, condensate. And then at the high temperatures, superconductivity disappears, and here also this component should disappear, and all the kind of gauge field should become massless. Here you will have a lot of processes. And unfortunately, things that about this thing, there will be no traces whatsoever, perhaps. Here nobody knows even. It's second order phase transition, crossover, probably crossover, but for sure people know now that it's not first order phase transition, therefore there will be no cosmological remnants of the quark-gluon phase transition. And for cosmology, who cares? It's second order phase transition or crossover. It's clear that here there happens liberation of the number degrees of freedom. So because you see, instead of one, for instance, proton, you have three quarks. And here the energy density is changing in an interesting way. Here also, it's not quite clear what happens there. Of course, you have to be able to produce in this theory a Bach, baryon asymmetry of the universe, many other things. There is a lot of nice physics, but it's not directly related with observation. It's not quite clear. Will it be ever related with observation or not? Yeah? Supersymmetry. And then here I think things are more or less clear. But when you go to the times, I will finish this lecture. Because I don't want to finish pessimistically, I want to finish optimistically. Lecture, yeah? So, and then when you go to the tides, which are in between 10 minus 14 seconds and 10 minus 43 seconds, then it's the physics beyond standard model. Here you still know the models which you apply, but here you have no ideas. And these energies, for instance, will be reached, perhaps, on LHC. And here there is no hope to reach this energy. So here you could look and say, but if here I can say only blah, 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 non-verifiable, blah, 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 what could I say here? Yeah? And of course, your first suspicion has ground, but it's wrong. Because here there is nice thing which is called inflation. Inflation, which took place at the time about 10 minus 35 seconds. And this inflation, irrespective of the physics beyond standard model, leaves very clear traces. Okay, which we could see in observations. Namely, it's large scale traces which concern the metric fluctuations in big scales, yeah? And also they concern the production of the gravity waves. These features of inflation, they do not depend on the physics beyond standard model. You see, and this is the reason why we could make some kind of surely robust statement and prediction about these kind of things which happen at the moment, 10 minus 35 seconds. And moreover, we can consider and we can compare it with the present observation, with the tiny details of these same fluctuations, pictures, because there are many pictures, and then we can verify the presence of this stage in the past, even if we will not know what kind of particle physics was responsible for it. You see? And therefore, of course, here you could actually still write a lot of papers trying to fill this gap, okay? No, besides of inflation, just don't touch inflation. Go either before inflation or after inflation, and then do whatever you want. I don't care. Yeah? But don't try to bring some kind of erotics, pyrotechnics, psychics, string motivated cosmology, etc., etc., etc. Because here everything is at the level of elementary school, yeah? And there is the level of psychiatric clinic. Therefore, actually, I would be, of course, I can answer the question, particular question. What I will be doing in the next lectures, I will be doing things not as a level of psychiatric clinic, but as a level of elementary school. And next lecture, I will go directly to inflation. After that, I will describe the theory of cosmological perturbations. Then I will try to relate it with the observational pictures of the same fluctuations. And if I will have time, okay, I reserve this last lecture, I will do nuclear synthesis because I spent a lot of time on this thing, but never talk about it. But it's always the case if I will have time. Okay, so thank you very much.